Thanks, Bill, for that introduction. I was going to try and sell my book to you, but Bill's already done that for me, so I don't need to worry about that anymore. Thanks also to the Philadelphia Society, and especially to Bill Campbell for his tireless efforts on behalf of this organization. It's always a great pleasure to be at a Philly Soc meeting to catch up with old friends and make new ones, so I'm very delighted to be here. I'm tasked today with speaking to you about progressivism and the Supreme Court. What I'm really going to say is a kind of distillation or Reader's Digest version of a much larger argument I make in my Living Constitution book that was just mentioned, which the book tries to outline the whole story of progressivism in the Supreme Court or progressivism's influence on the rule of law more generally. Well, this is a rather large river with many tributaries. I have to channel it rather quickly for you. I suggest that we begin this channeling by casting our minds back to an age that antecedes our own. And I think we should do this for purposes of contrast and therefore clarity. In 1863, Abraham Lincoln reminded his listeners that America was conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Earlier, Lincoln had proclaimed that all living Americans are the legal inheritors of the fundamental blessings bequeathed by the founders, whose principles, institutions, and very names we have a duty to preserve, not because they're old or merely useful, but because they're true. They're true because they're in conformity with the cause of civil liberty, of natural rights. Thus, they must shine on, according to Lincoln, in naked, deathless splendor. In Lincoln, we see a faith in the greatness of our founders and the regime they created. And the political rhetoric and actions of Lincoln remain, I think, among the greatest statements that there are such things as natural rights, which do not change with time, and that the American Constitution is dedicated to preserving them, and that the task of great political actors, while responding to urgent necessities, is to look backward as much as, or perhaps more, than forward. For him, the state should not be viewed as organic, as inevitably evolving away from the founder's constitution. Because history isn't destined to unfold in a democratic direction. Democracy itself, because of its indissoluble link with the passions rather than reason, is always precarious, at risk, combustible. Moral and political regress are as likely, perhaps likelier, than progress. Furthermore, there are certain fixed principles, the founders' principles, beyond which progress is impossible. The laws of nature and nature's God can't be improved on. Lincoln was profoundly wary of the very notion of progress. Evolution and growth were not part of his political vocabulary. Government's job was mainly and simply to protect the pre-political rights given to us by the laws of nature and nature's God. It's in Lincoln that we can see the culmination, I think, of this old understanding of the American constitutional order and the political principles that it enshrined. Lincoln's articulation of the nature and purposes of the American regime, I think, was perhaps the high watermark of this old constitutionalism, that is to say, the pre-progressive constitutionalism. Lincoln always looked backward to our founders. A new view would sweep the intellectual classes immediately after the age of Lincoln. Nowadays, our elites tend not to look back to the founders, but forward to an age when we can be less and less like the nation that our founders envisioned, to an age that rests on a progressive view of history. We are now told that our Constitution is a living document that must be interpreted, by the Supreme Court especially, to keep up with our progressive times. But this simply amounts to a rule of men rather than law. And I think a good part of the blame for this new view of the Constitution can be laid at the feet of those who interpreted, of all people, Charles Darwin as having a bearing not just on biology, but on politics and law as well. How is this possible? How can Darwin have anything to do with politics and law? Well, it turns out that he has a lot to do with them, thanks to the thinking of the so-called social Darwinists who came to dominate the intellectual classes of America in the second half of the 19th century. They applied Darwinian evolutionary concepts to politics and the Constitution. So that in America of the late 19th century, the old understanding of the nature and the permanent limits of politics was dead or dying. And I think we can summarize this transformation as a move away from the earlier constitutionalism of fixed principles, cognizable words, modest executive and judicial branches, the limits imposed by federalism, to instead an organic or progressive constitutionalism in which the very notion of fixity or constitutional principle is something that must be overcome. The transformation rests on the coalescing of several important strains of American political thought, certainly social Darwinism, which I've mentioned, but also pragmatism, philosophical pragmatism, the coalescing of these doctrines into a powerful intellectual force that decisively informed institutional and political attitudes and behaviors starting by the early 20th century. And these twin, closely allied doctrines equally adapted the concepts of organism, environment, adaptation, experimentation, the language of naturalism, of the natural sciences. These doctrines merged by the early 20th century into the political and intellectual movement known as progressivism, a potent intellectual cocktail indeed, which I think is nothing more than the politicization of these twin doctrines. And in this view, the progressive view, intelligent guidance, endless socio-political reform are always possible because no problem is understood to be an inherent facet of human nature. Everything is evolving, human beings and their institutions. This understanding is alone sufficient to distinguish social Darwinism or pragmatism from the political science of the Federalist and the Founders' Constitution. Many of the great progressive thinkers, such as Woodrow Wilson, whom I'm sure RJ will mention, were rather explicitly contemptuous of the American constitutional order, I think it's fair to say, which they understood as embodying Newtonian mechanical ideas and institutions that stand in the way of necessary progress, vital organic growth and change, long before the courage to change or hope and change were campaign slogans. These ideas ensconced themselves in the American political vocabulary thanks to the progressives. In the progressive view, history, with a capital H, is taking us somewhere. And furthermore, we need experts to tell us exactly where it is taking us and how to get there. So as the 20th century wears on, the judiciary, it turns out, is tasked with taking up the mantle of the most cutting-edge progressive reform. The judiciary is less, the power of the judiciary is less dispersed, less subject to checks and balances, separation of powers. It can be the concentrated force in American public life that can lead us toward a progressive vision of the future. So one of my central claims is that the judicial branch, more than any other, is the one that's adopted this historicist progressive view of the Constitution and constitutionalism. And under this view, the exact nature and degree of change or growth is dictated by judicial elites in accordance with their perceptions of the new realities that the progress of history imposes on constitutional interpretation. History requires occasional help from the jurists who are in a position to see and remove obstacles in the way of historical progress. Let me take just a few moments to consider in more detail this early social, I'll call it the social Darwinist movement, but it's also blended with strains of pragmatism. According to the social Darwinists and those who would follow in their footsteps, we have this new social science that's indebted to Darwin, whose organic, genetic, experimental logic can be brought to bear on an array of human problems that were heretofore considered insoluble, or at least perennial. Darwin comes to be understood as a political philosopher and political scientist, rejecting old modes and orders. And no one more explicitly, I think, lays out the nature of this new science than John Dewey, one of the most influential progressive philosophers and early educational reformers of the 20th century. In 1909, he wrote an essay entitled The Influence of Darwinism on Philosophy. And by the time he wrote it, I think he was effectively summarizing the intellectual tenor of his times. He was giving an account of the origins of an already dominant pattern of American social and political thought among America's elites. Now, Dewey, in this essay, claims that Darwin's Origin of Species marked a revolution not only in the natural sciences, but the social sciences as well. The social sciences could continue under their old form only under the pressures of habit and prejudice, he says. In Dewey's words, the influence of Darwin upon philosophy, he might as well have said on politics and jurisprudence as well, the influence of Darwin resides in his having conquered the phenomena of life for the principle of transition and thereby freed the new logic for application to mind and morals and life. Darwin, more than anyone else, allows us to move from old questions that have lost their vital appeal to our perceived new interests and needs. We don't solve old questions, according to Dewey. We get over them, he says. Old questions, this is a direct quote, old questions are solved by disappearing, evaporating, while new questions corresponding to the changed attitude of endeavor and preference take their place. doubtless the greatest dissolvent in contemporary thought of old questions, the greatest precipitant of new methods, new intentions, new problems, is the one affected by the scientific revolution that found its climax in The Origin of Species. Darwin, according to Dewey, lays hands upon the sacred arc of permanency. That's also a direct quote from Dewey. The sacred arc of permanency that had governed our understanding of human beings. Darwin challenged the most sacred cow in the Western tradition, one that had been handed down to us from the Greeks, the belief in the superiority of the fixed and the final, including the forms that had been regarded as types of fixity or perfection. Of course, Christian natural law philosophy had the same belief. But after Darwin, we moved toward genetic experimental processes and methods to guide our inquiries into politics and law, and of which tend to deny the very possibility of fixed truth. In fact, on Darwinian terms, change is of the very essence of the good, which is identified with organic adaptation, survival, and growth. Therefore, the need for maximally experimental social arrangements so that change in useless directions can quickly be converted into change in useful directions. The goal of philosophy is no longer to search after absolute origins or ends or purposes, but the processes that generate them, according to Dewey. So in the absence of fixity, morals, politics, religion are subject to radical renegotiation and transformation. Essences are no longer the highest objects of inquiry, or indeed any objects of inquiry. And Dewey wasn't alone. His elucidation of the utility of Darwinism to social science and the new philosophy of man, I think, builds on the thought of a number of major Darwinist thinkers, including names that are almost lost in the mists of history now, but people like William Graham Sumner, Lester Frank Ward, Webb Du Bois, and others. Together with Dewey, these men provided the intellectual categories of their age, and these are categories that continue to exert a powerful control over political and jurisprudential discourse to the present day. Collectively, they point to a view of society as an organism, constantly in the throes of change. If it doesn't change, it will die. For the social Darwinist to look backward, whether to founding principles or any other fixed standard of political right, reflects a death wish. According to the tenets of social Darwinism and pragmatism, change in itself becomes the purpose of life and government. It's always preferable to not changing. Oliver Wendell Holmes is the great transitional figure on the Supreme Court who brings Darwinism and Darwinian historical understandings to a kind of respectability or at least normalcy in judicial discourse. So on the foundations laid by the social Darwinists and those in allied movements, I think many of the most influential American political actors of the 20th century and even in the 21st century have come to share six core overlapping understandings of the nature of politics and constitutional government. The first is that there are no fixed or eternal principles that govern or ought to govern the politics of a decent regime. Old political categories are just that. Lincoln's understanding of the founder's constitution, to the extent it's worthy of any consideration at all, is a quaint anachronism. Secondly, that the state and its component parts are indeed organic, each involved in a struggle for never-ending growth and change. Third, democratic openness and experimentalism, especially in the expressive realm, are necessary to ensure vital growth. They are, as it were, the fertilizer of the organic state. Such experimentalism implies a particular sort of consequentialism in judging laws. Fourth, the state and its component parts exist only in history, understood as an inexorable process rather than a record of events, history that's moving us forward, everywhere forward. Fifth, and very important, of course, some individuals stand outside this process of history, like the captains of a great ship. They must adjust the position of the ship in the river of history to ensure it continues to move forward rather than run aground and stagnate. So politics always demands an elite class directed to doing this, so an elite class that springs into action to clear the blockages in the path of historical progress, whether these blockages are in the forms of anachronistic institutions, ideas, laws, and so forth. So the clever Washington insiders and Supreme Court justices become the philosopher kings of the new progressive age. And sixth and finally, a direct corollary to the strong historicism I've just mentioned is that all moral and political truth or rightness of action is relative to one's moment in history, the exact position of the ship in the river of time. Now, I claim that this understanding of history and these core understandings that I've just summarized grow directly out of American political thought, but furthermore, that they also account for something. some important things in actual constitutional jurisprudence. I wouldn't, of course, claim that they account for everything, but they are powerful and never far below the surface, even today, of the consciousness of any Supreme Court justices, left and right, Democratic and Republican. Let me give you a couple of quick recent examples. Take the dissent in the 2000 case, the 5-4 decision in the Boy Scouts case, which was penned by Justice Stevens. For Justice Stevens, unfavorable views of homosexuals are rooted in ancient prejudices, best likened, and I quote, to the equally atavistic opinions about certain racial groups, which opinions have been nourished, he says, by sectarian doctrine. Only habit, rather than analysis, appears to ground the man-woman distinction. Thus does Justice Stevens, in a single paragraph, take on and dismiss both revelation and classical moral reasoning. And he goes on in the same paragraph to substitute for them history, with a capital H, and historical progress, including the findings, of course, of social science, as revealed in history. Over the years, he says, interaction with real people rather than mere adherence to traditional ways of thinking about members of unfamiliar classes have modified opinions. He quotes the American Psychiatric Associations, the American Psychological Associations, removal of homosexuality from their lists of mental disorders, moves toward greater understanding and generally previous Supreme Court cases, which have been incrementally moving in this direction. And I think one of my favorite lines in constitutional jurisprudence, he says, indeed, the past month alone has witnessed some remarkable changes in attitudes about homosexuals. I investigated this at one point, trying to figure out what he was referring to. I believe he's referring to Gay Pride Day at the CIA, which was going on there. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But surely it can't be a ground for constitutional interpretation. Take Justice Kennedy, writing a few years later for the majority in Lawrence versus Texas, who asserts the importance of an emerging recognition of new rights worthy of judicial protection, in this case concerning homosexuality again. In all events, he claimed, we think our laws and traditions in the last half century are of most relevance here. An emerging awareness that liberty gives, you know, new protections. Only through recognition of such liberty, he says, can we avoid demeaning, stigmatizing the autonomous choices of individuals whose dignity is revealed in time. It's not a fixed thing. And I'll quote again from Justice Kennedy this time. Had those who drew and ratified the due process clauses of the Fifth Amendment or the 14th Amendment known the components of liberty and its manifold possibilities, they might have been more specific. Had they known what they were doing, they would have written it differently. They did not presume to have this insight. Or what about Justice Souter in the right to die cases, where he says, essentially, there's no right to die at this time. He'll allow legislative experimentation for now, but history will be the ultimate judge of whether there is such a thing. I could go on. In the case of Kennedy, Louisiana, 2008, Justice Kennedy held that the current national consensus is the basis for determining the circumstances in which the death penalty can be applied. Eighth Amendment has nothing to do with the text or traditions of the Constitution itself. The upshot of that case was there's no death penalty for child rape, no death penalty for almost anything except for murder. And if you read the facts of that case, and I encourage you to do so only if you have the stomach for it, it is a particularly gruesome, horrific set of facts. I don't know how I can say it except not even a normal child rape, if I may put it that way. And read the facts if you have the stomach. See if you think the Founders' Constitution precludes the death penalty for such a crime. And he also, of course, quotes world opinion, where world opinion has moved. So there's a line of progression, I claim, from progressivism to modern constitutional interpretations that seeks not so much victory as legitimation, or a way to bring this new progressivism into line with the people's constitution and the rule of law rather than the rule of men. It is, after all, the glory of the American people that they are in many ways anachronisms, I think, looking constantly backward to pre-modern or at least pre-19th century political categories for their guidance. For them, Lincoln's words still resonate. Their founding documents, their institutions, their founders live on in naked, deathless splendor. The courts and the legal professoriate have the guns, but the people have the numbers. I think it remains to be seen whether either side will stand down. Thank you.